Welcome back to this week's episode of The Emily Show. We are going to be covering a fairly new case because the court documents are finally available in the arrest of four regarding another child custody case that ended in a murder. It is shocking to me that there are multiples of these cases. So no, today we are not talking about Donna Adelson. We are not talking about what recently happened at a custody deposition in Las Vegas. If criminal charges come in that case, I will be following it, and I've talked about it on stream. Today, we are talking about Oklahoma. So with all of that, and not the texting judge, and this wouldn't have been in the texting judge's jurisdiction anyway. How do I know? I looked. We're going to go through the court documents. We're going to talk about what the charges are here. We are going to talk about what happened. This case is absolutely heartbreaking, and we need to have a conversation about what is going on with not only how dangerous custody cases can be, how contentious they can be, but how this is not the answer. Because at the end of the day, the person who is the most harmed, or the people who are the most harmed, are the children. And if you are trying to protect children, this is 100%. Not the way to go about it. So let's get into today's episode. Welcome to The Emily Show. I'm Emily D. Baker, the internet's go-to legal analyst and big fan of the cursy words. I've been a licensed attorney for over 17 years. I'm a former prosecutor, and I break down the legal side of pop culture and entertainment stories we can't stop talking about. We should just get into it. Let's go. Thank you to today's sponsor, Policy Genius. Life can be unexpected, which is why life insurance is needed, no matter what stage of life you're in. And I totally get that shopping for life insurance is something you may put off because it seems overwhelming or like too much to take on, but that's literally what Policy Genius is here to help with. They make it really easy to get the peace of mind that comes with knowing that if something happens to you, that your family can cover expenses while getting back on their feet. Policy Genius has licensed award-winning agents and technology that makes it easy to compare life insurance quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. That means they're not incentivized to recommend one over the other and can help you find the policy that's right for you. It's no wonder Policy Genius has thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot to save time and money while providing your family with a financial safety net. Head to policygenius.com or click the link below to get your free life insurance quote. Want to find out how much you can save? Head to policygenius.com. Let's get back to today's episode. So today, first, we are going to do a summary of this case, and then we are going to go into two different court documents. They do have some overlap, but for thoroughness, I thought we needed to go through both. This case started on March 30th when Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly disappeared. They are both from Kansas. 2 weeks later, four individuals were arrested and charged, each with two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of kidnapping, and one count of conspiracy to commit murder. Now that we have the court documents and the charging, and we know a little bit about what's going on in this case, I think it is the more appropriate time for me to cover it. When things are pending, I tend not to cover them until we have the court documents in front of us and have a little bit more of an idea of what's going on. And this case seems to be stemming out of a very contentious, almost 5 years long child custody battle that is absolutely heartbreaking. Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly disappeared on March 30th. Veronica Butler was going to pick up her children for a birthday party. Jillian Kelly was the court-ordered supervision as part of the custody that was ongoing with Veronica Butler, the children's father, and the children's grandmother, who was quite involved in this custody dispute as well. Butler's children that she was on the way to pick up are 6 and 8 years old, according to all the media reports that I have seen. Jillian Kelly had four children of her own. On April 15th, 2024, four people were arrested for their murders. and also charged, as I previously said, with those two counts of kidnapping and the count of conspiracy to commit murder. The police affidavits make it very clear, in addition to statements by one of the defendants, that Veronica Butler was targeted because of the ongoing custody dispute. And one of those arrested was the children's grandmother. So Tiffany Adams was the children's grandmother. She was in a relationship with co-defendant Tad Cullum. Tad, yes, Tad with an A. And then there are two other individuals involved in this, Cole and Cora Twombly. So we're going to go through all of the affidavits from law enforcement to kind of go through how they discovered this case and what was discovered about this case. But child custody should not end in opposing parties thinking that murdering one of the parents is the way that this should go down. Look, when murders are investigated, you look at the immediate circle, and then you look at who potentially has beef with the victim. Contentious child custody is going to be one of the first things law enforcement looks for. We saw this in the Adelson case. Did it take a while for them to get to the prosecution of Donna Adelson? Yes. Did it take them a tremendously long time to get to the charging of Charlie Adelson? Not that much. Did it take time to get to those who were hired to commit this murder? Hardly at all. We will see if any charges come from the shooting at a deposition in Las Vegas. If there are charges there, I will cover it. I don't know if there will be, because the party who perpetrated the shooting also took their own life. So will there be charges there? It is unknown at this time, but if they do, we will cover it. This is not the way to deal with it. And again, the people who are harmed in all of this so substantially are the kids. This is never going to go well, ever. It's just absolutely heartbreaking. Though, from the police affidavits, it does not look like this will be a difficult prosecution, but the kids have now lost their mother. They will likely lose their grandmother due to the prosecution. How is that helpful for anyone? All right, so we are going to look at all the filings with regard to Tiffany Adams, the grandmother in this case. There are filings for the other four defendants. We are not going to be going through those. They are substantially the same. Same charges, same affidavits, different names on the filings. And we're going to go through what is now known in court in this case. So for those of you listening, I'm going to be telling you what I am pulling up on screen. This is the information. This was filed in Texas County, Oklahoma. This is part of the Oklahoma Panhandle. If this is not your section of the United States, or you are not familiar with the geography in the United States, there is kind of a little strip of Oklahoma that goes along the kind of top of Texas in between Kansas and Texas, near where Kansas and Colorado share a border. So it is in between Texas and Kansas. It is a fairly small strip of the state of Oklahoma. So this is Texas County, Oklahoma, not Texas County, Texas, if that makes sense. So this is the information from April 12th, 2024, charging the grandmother, Tiffany Adams, with murder in the first degree in two counts, kidnapping in two counts, and conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree, one count. State of Oklahoma, County of Texas, I, George Leach, the undersigned district attorney of the county, in the name and by the authority of the state of Oklahoma, give information that in said county of Texas and in the state of Oklahoma, Tiffany Michelle, M-A-C-H-E-L, I think that is Michelle. Tiffany Michelle Adams did then and there unlawfully, willingly, knowfully, and wrongfully commit the crimes of murder in the first degree with deliberate intent, a felony, by aiding and abetting in the commission and deliberate and intentional taking away of life of a human being on or about the 30th day of March, 2024, and then and there willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously without authority of law, aid and abet in the death of Veronica Butler, who was lured to the location of Highway 95 and Road L in Texas County, Oklahoma, and certain mortal wounds were inflicted, and Veronica Butler did in fact die as a result of the wounds inflicted. This crime is punishable by death, imprisonment for life, or imprisonment for life without parole. So what this indicates is there are three potential sentences here for both of the murder charges in Oklahoma, which is the death penalty, life without parole, which means life in custody with not a chance to get parole, not a chance to get released, unless your sentence is commuted by the governor or your case is overturned on appeal, and then also imprisonment for life. Imprisonment for life in Oklahoma is a 45-year sentence. That varies greatly jurisdiction to jurisdiction across the United States, what a life sentence means. But life sentence means there is the potential of release or parole, different than LWOP or life without parole, different, obviously, than the death penalty. Continuing on, count two reads the exact same way for the other victim, Jillian Kelly. Count three is kidnapping, a felony on or about the 30th day of March, 2024, by aiding and abetting the forcible seizing of Veronica Butler from Highway 95 and Road L, County of Texas, Oklahoma, and confining Veronica Butler in another vehicle and transferring said victim to another location without lawful authority and with the intent to cause Veronica Butler to be confined or imprisoned against her will. The crime is punishable by imprisonment for not more than 20 years. The second count of kidnapping reads the same for victim Jillian Kelly. The final count, count five, is conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree with deliberate intent by conspiring and agreeing with, and then it lists the co-defendants, Tad Cullum, Cora Twombly, Cole Twombly, to commit the crime of murder in the first degree of felony on or about or between the 13th day of February 2024 and the 30th day of March 2024 by arranging and planning the deliberate, intentional, and unlawful taking away of life of Veronica Butler and or Jillian Kelly, and the defendant and or co-conspirators did purchase. And then it lists the acts they took in furtherance of the conspiracy. The acts in furtherance of the conspiracy they list as purchasing burner phones, stun guns, and then traveling to the area of Highway 95 and Road L in Texas County, Oklahoma, in furtherance of the conspiracy. That crime is punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years or a fine of not more than $5,000 or both. And that is signed by the district attorney in the area on April 12th, 2024. Interesting to note, and we will hear more of this as we get to the affidavits, that the conspiracy to commit murder talks about essentially a conspiracy between the 13th day of February and the 30th day of March. Interestingly, we also see similar timing, maybe not as long, in like the Corey Richens case, where she first attempted, according to prosecutors, to poison her husband on Valentine's Day with a sandwich and then ended up killing him early in March. We here have the conspiracy between the 13th day of February and the 30th day of March. And as we get into the facts of this case, we will see that there was a plan for an earlier date for this homicide that fell through. And then the March 30th date became the day that they carried out this murder. The second document we are going to take a look at is the motion to hold the defendant without bail. We're not going to look at the entirety of the motion that was filed on April 16th, 2024, because the heart of this is really the affidavit, and that's what we are going to focus on. But the affidavit is attached to that motion to hold the defendant without bail. All four defendants have been held without bail. And I should have mentioned at the beginning of the episode and did not, that with all four defendants being held without bail, they have all been appointed public defenders. And there is a status hearing set for May 15th, 2024 in this case in Oklahoma. So that is the date I would anticipate they will start setting dates for preliminary hearing, discovery deadlines, perhaps a trial date, and start moving the case forward from there. In the motion to hold the defendant without bail, it talks about the continuing threat to society. So we're going to cover that and then get into the affidavit. It says the evidence shows that the defendant and co-conspirators engaged in a plot to kidnap and murder the deceased, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, in order to prevent the lawful granting of custody and or unsupervised visitation by the court. The defendant and conspirators attempted said crime previously by both traveling to Houghton in an attempt to lure Veronica out of her home and additionally planning to organize her death by throwing an anvil through her windshield as she drove down the road. It goes on to cite case law that talks about the planning of murders and the callousness being grounds to deny someone bail and to hold them without bail. They then talk about the crimes both being violent offenses under the law, and that there shall be a rebuttable presumption that no condition of release would assure the safety of the community. They then talked about the maximum potential sentences, including death, life, or LWOP, and the sentence for kidnapping being 20 years. They say proof of guilt is evident, saying that the attached affidavit details the relevant facts. And it says the state would point out that after arrest, this defendant, Tiffany Adams, did provide a recorded statement to law enforcement indicating her responsibility for the death of the deceased. So there is also a recorded confession of some nature in this case. Getting into the affidavit of fact, and this is the more thorough affidavit. This is the affidavit to deny bail or bond, which was in fact denied in court. Different than the probable cause to arrest or the PCA, which we will go through after this. This one, again, being more thorough. So we will go through this one first and then go through the other one. The affidavit starts with, on Sunday, March 30th, 2024, the Texas County Sheriff's Office requested Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, the OSBI, which as we cover this, you're going to hear OSBI a lot, requested OSBI investigative services with the suspicious disappearance of Veronica Butler, 27, and Jillian Kelly, 39, from a rural area of Texas County after their vehicle was found abandoned near Highway 95 and Road L, south of Elkhart, Kansas. Butler and Kelly were traveling to Oklahoma from Houghton. Interviews were conducted related to the disappearance, and it was discovered that Butler was in a problematic custody battle with Tiffany Adams for the custody of Butler's two children. I don't know when I have seen the word problematic come up in legal filings more than in the last year. The word problematic has definitely gained mainstream appeal in legal cases because I have seen it over and over again. I'm like, what did we used to say? We didn't say problematic. Troubling? Contentious? Anyway, problematic has now taken over. A problematic custody battle with Tiffany Adams for the custody of Butler's two children. The father of those children was Wrangler Rickman Adams' son. I don't know why this was a was, not an is, and I don't know, and it is not clear from any of the reporting on this case I have seen, if the son, Wrangler Rickman, son of defendant Tiffany Adams, lost parental custody of the children and the grandmother has custody of them, not the father, but the father, we'll get to where the father was during this because the police listed out in the affidavit, but it says the father of those children was Wrangler Rickman, Adams' son, and that's odd because he is not deceased, so the past tense is strange for me. It goes on to say Butler's visitation with her children was court-ordered to be supervised every Saturday. Adams had a particular person she preferred to supervise those visitations, and that was Cheryl Brune. The court ordered Adams to pay for Brune to supervise visits if that was who she wanted to be present. Otherwise, Butler was to pay for the person to supervise. So Butler, the mother, had to pay for the court-ordered supervisor unless Adams, the grandmother and defendant, specified that it could only be her preferred person, Cheryl. And if it was her preferred person, Cheryl, then she had to pay. Adams said Brune was unavailable to supervise the visitation on March 30th, 2024, so Butler, the victim and mother, was required to arrange the supervision with one of her three approved individuals. Butler contacted Kelly of Houghton and planned to have her supervise the visit. It goes on to say Butler told family members she was going to pick up her children from Adams at 1000 hours at Four Corners, an intersection of Highway 95, US 64 West, a location in Texas County, Oklahoma. That's not unusual that exchanges of custody happen at intersections, at gas stations, at public places, and not at people's home, especially when things are contentious. Butler and Kelly left Houghton, Kansas, and traveled Highway 95 to Road L, about 5 miles north of Four Corners. Butler and Kelly arrived at that location at approximately 9:40 a.m. Butler planned to bring her daughter to a birthday party, but after they did not arrive, the family began looking for Butler. Melissa and Joey Padilla, who were Butler's family members, located Butler's abandoned vehicle just west of intersection on Highway 95 and Road L. The Padillas then contacted law enforcement at 12:09 hours, so right after noon. An examination of the vehicle and area surrounding the vehicle found evidence of severe injury. Blood was found on the roadway and the edge of the roadway. Butler's glasses were found in the roadway south of the vehicle near a broken hammer. A pistol magazine was found inside Kelly's purse, but no pistol was found. And I wondered if, in reading this, the court-ordered supervisor also worried about how contentious this was and brought a weapon because these exchanges can be contentious. It just makes me wonder if Kelly, the court-ordered supervisor, was traveling armed for personal protection. Adams told OSBI that on Friday night, this is Adams' defendant, that on Friday night, March 29th, Rickman and Butler's children stayed the night with Barrett and Lacey Cook. Adams said she planned to pick them up that morning before visitation. Adams said she called Butler at 9 o'clock to confirm the meeting, and Butler told Adams something came up and she was not going to make it. So Adams told police that Adams' defendant told police that the victim, Butler, told her that she wasn't going to come and pick up the children. Butler's phone records confirmed the call occurred. However, at the time of the call, Butler was in Houghton, Kansas, in the process of picking Kelly up to go meet Adams. Adams stated that she was home at the time that Butler and Kelly went missing. Adams picked up the children before noon from the Cook's residence. OSBI interviewed Brune. Cheryl Brune was the preferred court supervisor of the defendant here, Tiffany Adams. OSBI interviewed Brune, and she said she was available to supervise the visit that day, but Adams told her to take a couple weeks off from visitation so Adams could question the children related to how Butler's approved visitation supervisors were. Butler and Kelly's phone records indicated their devices were actively sending signals to their carriers until approximately 9:42 a.m., after which the devices were no longer seen by the networks and stopped transmitting. This was a very large factor, I think, in the Murdaugh case. When did the victims' phones go silent? When, especially with how active most are on their phones, when the phones are either shut off or stopped transmitting can be a very crucial piece of information in putting together a arrest or a prosecution. The affidavit goes on to say that neither phone was found at the scene or within the vehicle, and they are currently missing. Adams, the defendant here, was the last known person to communicate with Butler and was scheduled to meet Butler and Kelly for visitation at 10 a.m. on March 30th. Through the child custody case, recordings were obtained where Rickman, the father of the children and son of the defendant, discussed death threats by Adams and Adams's boyfriend, Tad Cullum, who was a co-defendant in this case. The custody battle began in February of 2019 with many hearings and court appearances. When I say that if this is ongoing and when people go missing, they will look at the immediate circle first, of course, they pulled the court records as quickly as possible. So the children's father was saying that there were death threats by the grandmother, now defendant, and the grandmother's boyfriend, Tad, co-defendant. And the custody battle had been ongoing since February of 2019. On March 18th and March 20th, motions were filed requesting extended visitation for Butler, the victim in this case, and mother of the children. A hearing was scheduled to occur on April 17, 2024. Butler's attorney informed OSBI that Butler was likely to receive unsupervised visitation with her children at that hearing. Some of you may ask, or be asking to yourselves, but Emily, I know from other cases that we have discussed, including the Petito Laundry civil lawsuit, that even though Butler has been killed in this case, the attorney-client privilege still extends to cover communications between Butler and her attorney. Yes. However, Butler's attorney, I think, has the ability under the rules of ethics to say what they anticipated at the hearing because that does not disclose confidential communications between the attorney and the client, and it can give context to everything that's happening in this investigation, including that filings were made in the custody case on March 18th and March 20th, and the attorney expected that there would be more visitation for Butler after those hearings on April 17th, which can give context again to the police investigation. So that is not privileged information that the attorney can't disclose. At times, Adams, the defendant here and grandmother, refused to let Rickman, the father, have his children, even though Rickman had legal custody of them. Well, that answered my question. Why did this affidavit refer to him in the past tense earlier? That is strange. So that clears things up a bit. Law enforcement previously responded to a call for service where Adams, the defendant and grandmother here, refused to give Rickman his children. Reportedly, the officer told Rickman he believed the children were better off in Adams's care. Now, I don't know what was going on that call. I'm sure that will be looked into. I don't know the nature of that call. I don't know the surrounding circumstances of that call. Law enforcement does. We do not. Rickman's grandmother, I know this is getting to the point where some of you are going, Emily, do we have a chart? Rickman is the father of the children. His mother is defendant Tiffany Adams. His grandmother is Tiffany Knox Davis. So Rickman, father of children's grandmother, told law enforcement that in mid to late February 2024, the children's father, Rickman, told her they didn't have to worry about the custody battle much longer because the grandmother told law enforcement that Rickman, the father of the children, told her that they didn't have to worry about the custody battle much longer because Adams, the defendant in this case and mother, had it under control and that she knew the path the judge walked to work and, quote, we will take out Veronica at drop-off. Veronica, the victim here. So at some point, Tiffany Adams, the grandmother, told her son that they could take out the judge because they knew how the judge walked to work and they would take out the mother of the children at drop-off. That's in February, which is playing into, again, that conspiracy to commit murder is charged between February 13th and March 30th. Rickman, the father of the children, was confirmed to be in a rehabilitation facility in Oklahoma City at the time of the disappearance. The children remain in the custody of Adams, the grandmother defendant. Rickman denied having told his grandmother, Debbie Knox Davis, that information. Everybody's been interviewed before we got to these arrests. On April 1st, 2024, OSBI agents obtained a search warrant for Adams's cell phone. This is before any arrest was made. This is the day after the victims go missing. And while they were still considered missing, but they had enough information to get a search warrant for the cell phone. OSBI agents performed an extraction of the device. Information gained from the device included web searches for taser pain level, gun shops, prepaid cellular phones, and how to get someone out of their house. On April 3rd, OSBI interviewed CW, age 16. CW is the daughter of Cora Twombly and Kobe White. Kobe White is not one of the named defendants in this case. Cora is married to Cole Twombly. Look, I know there's a chart needed at this point. I know it's a lot, but CW is the daughter of Cora. Cora is now married to Cole. Cora and Cole are co-defendants. It feels like I'm telling you about people that everybody knew in junior high. I know. CW stated that she overheard group conversations related to Butler not protecting her children from her brother, Butler, the victim here, and mother of the children, all in reference to sexual abuse allegations. CW advised that she was told by Cora, her mother, that Adams, defendant, Cullum, Adams's boyfriend, Cora and Cole, and Paul Grice, G-R-I-C-E, Grice, not charged, were involved in the deaths of Butler and Kelly. I don't know why everyone's talking so much, but everyone is very communicative. This teen stated that Adams provided burner phones to use so they could communicate without using their personal devices. And CW, the teen, saw the two burner phones charging on Cora's nightstand in her bedroom. So one of the co-defendants either told her teen a number of things, and the teen saw literally everything going on in this house and told law enforcement all of it. CW described Cora, Cole, Adams, Cullum, and Paul as being part of an anti-government group that had religious affiliations. Through the OSBI investigation, it was learned that they called themselves God's Misfits. Regular meetings were held weekly at the Twombleys and the home of Barrett and Lacey Cook. So if you have seen this case referred to by the God's Misfits names, this affidavit is why. I don't know. I don't want to give their group name the recognition based on what they're alleged to have done. Like, no. Just for me, no. This is right now the only case I'm covering in Oklahoma, and it's going to be like that for me. But the teen saw and heard everything, and the teen continues to tell law enforcement what's going on. CW was told on March 29th that Cora and Cole would not be home in the morning when she woke up, and they were going to be on a quote-unquote mission. When CW awoke at approximately 10 a.m., Cora and Cole were not home but returned later. CW knew that Cole and Cora took a blue and gray Chevy pickup owned by them and a blue flatbed pickup owned by Clint Twombly when they left, and they returned in the same vehicles. CW was told to clean the interior of the Chevy pickup. CW asked Cora, her mother, what happened and was told things did not go as planned, but that they would not have to worry about her, the victim Butler, mother of the children, again. It's an awful lot to tell your teen, I think. CW asked about Kelly and why she had to die and was told by Cora that she wasn't innocent either, as she supported Butler. CW asked Cora if their bodies were put in a well, and Cora replied, quote unquote, something like that. This is a lot. This is a lot to confess a murder to your teenager and ask them to clean up the truck. Like, what? Good for you, CW. Good for you. I hope that CW is able to get the therapy and support that they need to recover from all of this and whatever else all of this entails, because fucking hell, this is a lot. And the teen has literally told law enforcement everything, which I imagine in a small community doesn't always go well. And I hope that that is not a problem for this teen. CW also disclosed that other attempts to kill Butler, the mother in this case, occurred during February of 2024 near Haughton, Kansas, in which Adams, Cullum, Cole, Cora, and that Paul guy who has not been charged went to Kansas, but Butler did not leave her residence. The victim would not come out of her house. This is consistent with the web search discovered on defendant Tiffany Adams, the grandmother's phone, about how to get someone out of their house. CW stated that Cora told her the plan to kill Butler in Kansas was to get in front of her while she was driving and throw an anvil through her vehicle windshield. The plan was designed to look like an accident. Quote, this is direct quote, I'm still reading from the affidavit. As anvils fall off work trucks regularly in the area. What? Y'all, look, I've been to Kansas like twice. I have driven briefly through Oklahoma. Where are anvils just falling off of work trucks? What are people using anvils for? But I grew up in a generation back in my day. Emily, are you digressing because this is awful and you're mad? Yes. I grew up in a generation where if there is a log truck in front of you, you move out of the way. The way I do not drive with cars that have logs, lumber, ladders, and other things that might go flying off of them because I have seen Final Destination way too many times. Look, I do not understand this belief that anvils just go through windshields of cars, quote, regularly. I'm not buying any of it at all. Nope. I'm just not buying it. But it seems that that was their original plan and that this victim was being targeted for more than a few months. The OSBI investigation, getting back to this affidavit and away from my rant about a Final Destination and the way that an entire generation perceives the vehicles in front of them. The OSBI investigation showed that Adams purchased 3 prepaid cellular phones from Walmart in Gaiman on February 13th, 2024. The phones were identified by phone numbers, and those are all listed. I redacted them out except for the last 4, which are irrelevant for our purposes today. Search warrants for information related to location services and phone usage were completed for each device. Look, I know they thought they were clever getting burner phones, but then they found the transaction on Walmart, located the phone numbers, and guess what? The burner phones still connect to a cell phone network. So if they have the numbers of the burner phones, they're going to have all the information too. So your internet searches were not as fruitful as you had hoped. It was learned that all 3 phones were at the area where Butler's car was located and the last known location of Butler and Kelly at the time of their disappearance. Yeah, your burner phones will tell on you if your burner phones are connected to you. And the burner phones are connected to you because you purchased them at Walmart. The purchase was tied back to you. The teen saw them with co-defendant, and the numbers were tracked. And the numbers of the burner phones were where the victims were last seen. So that's not going to go well. It goes on to say, after the victim's disappearance between 10:16 and 10:35, it was determined that the phone numbers were at a property owned by Jamie Beasley below a dam in the pasture near the area of freshly disturbed dirt. Concrete was moved from a location near Beasley's residence, approximately 150 to 200 yards below the dam, where it was discovered that a hole had been dug and filled back in. So after the victims were taken from the vehicle, the burner phones remained on and made it very clear where everybody went. Isn't that interesting? It seemed that the victims' phones were turned off, but the burner phones weren't. The affidavit goes on to say the location where Butler and Kelly disappeared from and where Butler's vehicle was located is approximately 8.5 miles away from the location below the dam on Beasley's property, giving drive time from the location of where Butler's vehicle was located to Beasley's property well within the 34 minutes between the time of Butler and Kelly's phones stopping transmission and the prepaid phones, 2 of the prepaid phones, arriving at the dam on Beasley's property. All prepaid phones stopped transmitting on the morning of March 30th at location near Twombly's residence and Beasley's property. So they did turn them off at some point, just not soon enough. And I'm glad they didn't. There's a lot of evidence in this affidavit. Beasley advised that the dirt work was done with a skid steer. Look, in California, they would have described in parentheses what a skid steer is. I kind of love in Oklahoma, they're like, if you know, you know. There's no need to describe it. Machinery was often described in California. There was an assumption that people didn't know what they were doing. But Beasley advised law enforcement that the dirt work was done with a skid steer by Cullum on March 29th, 2024, and was possibly finished on March 30th, 2024 in the morning hours. So when you talk about a first-degree murder, there is always an element of premeditation. And often, especially when things that seem to happen in the moment, you will have to explain in closing arguments premeditation to a jury. I think if the facts of the case come out that quote-unquote dirt work in the form of a hole was done the day before the murder, and then that was filled in after the murder, it's going to be much easier for prosecutors to explain premeditation when someone is literally digging a hole. It's absolutely horrific. But when you're looking at what's going to happen at trial, if this even goes to trial, there's not going to be a lot to argue here about premeditation, I don't think. It goes on to say Beasley knew that Cullum left his skid steer on his property the night of March 29th. And when he awoke on March 30th at approximately noon, the skid steer was gone. Cullum rents the pasture property owned by Beasley for cattle grazing and had access to it at any time. On March 28th or 29th, Cullum asked, remember, Cullum is the grandmother, Tiffany Adams's boyfriend. Cullum asked Beasley if he could cut down a tree, remove a stump, and bury some concrete, do dirt work where the concrete pile was, and below the dam. Adams was with Cullum at Beasley's property when the conversation was had. In a contact with Cullum, your affiant, the law enforcement officer writing this, learned from Cullum that Adams is his significant other. So Adams, the grandmother and defendant here, Cullum, the co-defendant, were dating in some form. Beasley agreed to allow Cullum to do the work. Cullum brought up the idea of doing the work to Beasley. So Beasley didn't reach out and ask Cullum to do any of this work. Tad Cullum, defendant, boyfriend, went to Beasley, owner of property, and said, hey, can I do this stuff? And he was like, yeah, sure. On Sunday, March 31st, in the morning hours, Cullum was at Beasley's house and told Beasley, Cullum being Tad, the grandmother and defendant Tiffany's boyfriend, that people were looking at him for the disappearance of Butler and Kelly. This was all over regional news. And this is something that started making national news as this disappearance went on. Tad Cullum told Beasley that he didn't want the police or people to cause problems for Beasley and said that all the skid steer tracks on his property without a skid steer looked bad. Beasley said that if anyone asked, he would tell them that Cullum had done tree or dirt work for him. So remember, Beasley is the owner of the property. Cullum rents a portion of that property for pasture land. Cullum is a defendant dating Tiffany Adams, co-defendant. Beasley is not charged. He is a witness landowner. OSBI investigation showed that Adams had searched for gun shops on her cell phone. A search of local gun shops showed Adams buying 5 stun guns at the Big R store in Gaiman. The purchase was made on March 23rd, 2024. The property near Beasley's residence, where the disturbed dirt was located, was leased by Cullum, Tad. Cullum grazed his cattle and accessed the property regularly to feed his animals. On or about March 29th, Cullum used a skid steer to dig a hole and bury concrete at the site near the dam. On April 13th, law enforcement agents executed a search warrant on Beasley's property. The area of disturbed dirt was excavated and the bodies of 2 individuals were discovered. I'm sure that is not a surprise to any of you. The state of the bodies indicated they died as a result of foul play. I'm not getting into any more detail on that, and neither does this affidavit. No more is needed. Further, a stun gun was also located at the excavation site. Look, if you're burying things, don't drop stuff. After her arrest on April 13th, 2024, during a custodial interview, and they're indicating this because I imagine that Miranda happened because they are very, very clearly making it known that this was a custodial interview after arrest. Adams, this defendant, the grandmother of the children, made statements to law enforcement indicating she was responsible for the deaths of Butler and Kelly. So there is a confession of some sort. At a hearing scheduled for April 17th, Butler would potentially have been granted unsupervised visitation with her children, Butler the victim. Adams vehemently opposed this and went to great lengths to plan and purchase the items used in Butler and Kelly's murders. The crimes and the bodies were concealed. The attempts were made to obscure Adams, Cullum, Cora, and Cole's whereabouts at the time of the murder. Adams, Cullum, Cole, and Cora were willing to kidnap and murder 2 victims to limit visitation for victim Butler. They are therefore willing to take, and this is all caps underlined, any extreme violent measures to protect themselves and thwart the criminal justice process. It goes on to say that Adams and Cullum co-defendants, Adams being the grandmother. Adams and Cullum have a history of violent interactions, including death threats and intimidation against individuals who disagree with their ideas. Members of the conspiracy participated in multiple attempts to murder Butler in the states of Oklahoma and Kansas. They abide by their own philosophy and have no regard for the sanctity of human life. It goes on to say that all four co-defendants have resources sufficient to organize and execute a complex murder. Therefore, they also have the resources to flee if given the opportunity. At the time of his arrest, Cullum had a rifle, ammunition, body armor, and a go bag prepared at his residence. Adams and Cullum pose a grave danger to witnesses and community members. No conditions exist which would effectively assure the safety of the community or any person involved in this case, including court officials, should they be released. And then it ends with, further, the affiant saith not, which you know is my favorite form of affidavit, as we learned from South Carolina. So because there's a lot of names involved in that, the key witnesses to this are one of the co-defendant's daughters, who the teen, CW, who said, oh yeah, they asked me to clean the truck. They told me Butler's no longer a problem. They had burner phones. They told me where the burner phones came from. The teen knows everything. The teen knows that a prior murder plot didn't go as intended. The teen knows all of it. You know that law enforcement is going to be monitoring the hell out of all of these jail calls to try to see if any witness intimidation happens between these four co-defendants, and particularly the teen, because it is all part of the affidavit. So it is public knowledge what the teen told law enforcement, or at least some of what the teen told law enforcement. Beasley, the owner of the property, also has quite a lot of information about this case because Beasley connects all of Cullum, the co-defendant, boyfriend of the grandmother of the children, Adams, was the one on the property digging a hole the day before the murders, was saying that work was going to be done down by the dam, and all of that work correlates to the movements of those burner phones that were purchased at Walmart. There is also a probable cause affidavit for the arrest. We're going to take a look at that real quick. But first, I wanted to go to an article from CNN that has a really good map of the sites involved in this because they are pretty close together. Thank you to today's sponsor, Honeylove, for making episodes like this one possible. As the weather is changing from spring into summer, it's time to consider whether you need to spring clean your bra drawer. I know that it's not something we often think about until we are uncomfortable at the end of the day going, what have I been doing to myself all day long with this uncomfortable bra? Honeylove is here for you. Honeylove's bras feature supportive bonding that eliminate the need for underwire, and they're made with a fabric that is so soft, it really feels like you are supported by a second skin. You'll immediately see and feel the difference with your new Honeylove bras. Honeylove's best-selling crossover bra is so comfortable, it will be your everyday go-to. It gives all the support of a traditional bra without using any underwire, and the mesh detailing adds just a nice little touch. And of course, all of Honeylove's bras are designed with back-smoothing fabric to prevent that awful bra bulge that we all hate. If you're ready to treat yourself to the best bras on the market and save 20% off at honeylove.com/lawnerd, you can use our exclusive link down below at honeylove.com/lawnerd to get 20% off. And after your purchase, they're going to ask how you heard about them. Please let them know you found them through The Emily Show. Let's get back to today's episode. So this is reporting coming from CNN. It has the booking photos of all four defendants, including the top row, Cole Twombly and his wife, Cora Twombly. The bottom is Tad Cullum and Tiffany Adams. Tiffany Adams being the grandmother of the children, who seems to be, from everything here, at least the instigator behind the plot to take out the mother of her grandchildren. I don't know if this was a daughter-in-law or not a daughter-in-law. It doesn't really matter. This is the mother of her grandchildren. They also included pictures of both of the victims, Jillian Kelly and Veronica Butler, the mother of the children, and the intersection of Highway 95 and Road L, which is a very flat dirt road, no trees, very little brush, a stop sign and some telephone poles, and not much else. So I don't expect there's any recording or building recordings out in this area. It is just a very kind of desolate and remote location. The helpful map put together from CNN shows not only the area of the Oklahoma-Kansas border that we're talking about, because they are fairly close together, but also goes through and shows the different residences and where the pasture land was. The pickup intersection was not very far from the birthday party that victim Butler was going to be taking her children to. So I will link that article down below as well. So for those of you on the podcast, if you want to pull it up and take a look at kind of the layout of this area and where things happened, where the car was found, where the bodies were located, you can. Now we're going to go quickly over the probable cause for arrest. It is not as detailed as the motion to deny bond. I understand why. The probable cause needed for arrest, you can kind of go through the overview of these things, but it was clear that the prosecution felt very strongly that if these individuals were released from custody, not only would there be a threat to court officials and witnesses, but also a huge threat of them fleeing. And I can understand, given everything that they know, and we only know a fraction of what they know, given everything that's been made public with Adams allegedly saying, "I know the way the judge walks to the courthouse," that would be a concern. So this probable cause affidavit was filed on April 12th, 2024, and starts with, "I am Special Agent Jason Ott of the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, OSBI, as we're going to be referring to it," goes through and lists the 27 years in law enforcement, over 20 years as an investigator. What's interesting to note in this probable cause affidavit is that law enforcement makes a note that while interviewing CW and her brother, Cora and Cole Twombly, who are now defendants in this case, arrived and tried to get access to CW and her brother while they were interviewing with police. Cora, the now defendant, this is before the arrest, was verbally aggressive and very upset, it says, with your affiant, the law enforcement officer, that she was not granted access to the 16-year-old CW and her brother. Cole exited the vehicle armed with a handgun in a holster on his belt. This is before any of them are arrested, but it also shows the panic when law enforcement is talking to the teen and her brother. That is not in the other affidavit. It then goes on to talk about the cell phone searches for guns and the purchasing of 5 stun guns, the purchasing of the prepaid phones, the travel path of the prepaid phones, and then it talks about the phones all being near Beasley's property, and that is the end of the affidavit to arrest. There is no further information in that. So the affidavit we went through for the bond was much more thorough, but I thought it was very interesting to note that when it was discovered that law enforcement was interviewing the teen CW and her brother, that the defendants arrived and were less than thrilled, quote unquote, verbally aggressive. It will be very interesting to see how that plays out at trial, because it will absolutely be brought up by the prosecution as consciousness of guilt, knowing what Cora and Cole had told CW, knowing what CW had seen and heard, and then knowing that CW was being spoken to by law enforcement is definitely going to play at trial, if this goes to trial, as consciousness of guilt. Will this case go to trial? I don't know. Could this case take a plea deal? I don't know if prosecutors in Oklahoma would be inclined to do that. I would imagine the only plea deal they would even be minimally inclined to make would be to take the death penalty off the table and let everyone serve life without the possibility of parole. I don't know if they'll even be inclined to do that, given A, the amount of evidence they have, B, the horrific nature of these murders, and C, how long they were planning them is all going to go towards the prosecution saying, no, this just goes to trial. There's no option here. There's no deal here. There is nothing we're taking off the table here. This case is just going directly to trial. The amount of evidence in the affidavits is fairly substantial. And that's not even all of it, right? So with affidavits that are that substantial, it will be interesting to see how the prosecution chooses to move forward with this case. I don't know if it will go quickly or not, if they end up being death penalty cases. You've seen how quickly those go, not at all. And those will go the nature of the Idaho cases. But when I saw another case that was a contentious child custody case ending in one of the children's parents being murdered, I was, frankly, my first response was anger. Butler's children are 6 and 8. Their father was in rehab at the time that this happened. Their grandmother is now facing the death penalty. Their mother has been murdered. It is so many lives devastated for what? So that the mother would not see the children as much? We will see how this case moves forward. But between this, between the Richens case, the Donna Adelson case, the Las Vegas deposition shooting, it is a really horrific amount of cases going on that is just devastating for the children and the communities and is never the solution. So I wanted to cover this now that the court documents were out. I know that I got a lot of requests to look into this case when both of the victims were missing, but I don't generally cover quite a lot of missing unless I can help in some way. And until the court documents are in, it's really hard to know which way something is going to go. I was heartbroken by the case in Vegas, which is why I covered it on stream to chat about it a little bit and about how dangerous family law can be, how contentious these things can be. And for all of you that have gone through contentious divorces and child custody cases, I know the toll that it takes on you. It's not easy and it changes everybody involved. I wish there was a better way. I don't know what that better way would be, but it seems that open communication and a court system that takes people saying that they feel afraid seriously while still not letting people game the system with false accusations, it's a difficult balance for courts to strike, and it is not always done well. Hopefully, we will see the prosecution in this case move quickly, the children be placed with somebody who can take care of them and help them recover from the devastation that this has wrought on their family. But in a case with this much digital evidence and at least 2 confessions, it should move quickly. And with that, thank you for being a Law Nerd. Thank you for being here. The Karen Reed case I meant to cover at the beginning, and then I got right into this and didn't. The Karen Reed case has stalled a little bit as they are picking a jury. So stay tuned on the Law Nerd app to know when the opening statements begin, because I keep hearing mixed things between opening statements later this week, opening statements early next week. We're just going to have to go day by day and see what happens in that case. But they don't have a jury yet. The jury is not coming back till the day this goes live on Wednesday. I record these on Monday, so it's hard to really get a gauge for what's going to happen between now and Wednesday, but it looks like opening statements are going to potentially be next week, which is wild. So we will see what happens there. With all of it, thank you for being here. Thank you for being a Law Nerd. Say it with me. May your Wi-Fi be strong. May your toilet paper be plentiful. May your families be well. May the odds be ever in your favor. Thank you for being a Law Nerd. I will see you in the next one. You can stay up to date with everything I'm covering on our free iOS and Android app at lawnerdapp.com, or search your app store for Law Nerd. And you can also follow me on social media at The Emily D. Baker. Remember, I stream on YouTube on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I recap all of that for you in quick bits on Monday. And of course, The Emily Show drops on Wednesdays. Thanks for being a Law Nerd.